Chapter 6. Maki, he weighed 110 pounds. His hair was kinky and negroid, and he was black. He was peculiarly black. He was neither blue black nor purple black, but plum black. His name was Maki, and he was the son of a chief. He had three tambos. Tambo is Melanesian for taboo, and is first cousin to that Polynesian word. Maki's three tambos were as follows. First, he must never shake hands with a woman, nor have a woman's hand touch him, or any of his personal belongings. Secondly, he must never eat clams nor any food from a fire in which clams had been cooked. Thirdly, he must never touch a crocodile, nor travel in a canoe that carried any part of a crocodile, even if as large as a tooth. Of a different black were his teeth, which were deep black, or, perhaps better, lamb black. They had been made so in a single night, by his mother, who had compressed about them a powdered mineral which was dug from the landslide back of Port Adams. Port Adams is a saltwater village on Malaita, and Malaita is the most savage island in the Solomons, so savage, that no traders or planters have yet gained a foothold on it. While, from the time of the earliest B.G.D. Murfishers and sandalwood traders down to the latest labor recruiters equipped with automatic rifles and gasoline engines, scores of white adventurers have been passed out by tomahawks and soft-nosed Snyder bullets. So Malaita remains today, in the 20th century, the stamping ground of the labor recruiters, who farm its coasts for laborers who engage and contract themselves to toil on the plantations of the neighboring and more civilized islands for a wage of $30 a year. The natives of those neighboring and more civilized islands have themselves become too civilized to work on plantations. Maki's ears were pierced, not in one place, nor two places, but in a couple of dozen places. In one of the smaller holes he carried a clay pipe. The larger holes were too large for such use. The bowl of the pipe would have fallen through. In fact, in the largest hole in each ear he habitually wore round wooden plugs that were an even 4 inches in diameter. Roughly speaking, the circumference of said holes was 12.5 inches. Maki was Catholic in his tastes. In the various smaller holes he carried such things as empty rifle cartridges, horseshoe nails, copper screws, pieces of string, braids of sennit, strips of green leaf, and, in the cool of the day, scarlet hibiscus flowers. From which it will be seen that pockets were not necessary to his well-being. Besides, pockets were impossible, for his only wearing apparel consisted of a piece of calico several inches wide. A pocket knife he wore in his hair, the blade snapped down on a kinky lock. His most prized possession was the handle of a china cup, which he suspended from a ring of turtle shell, which, in turn, was passed through the partition cartilage of his nose. But in spite of embellishments, Maki had a nice face. It was really a pretty face, viewed by any standard, and for a Melanesian it was a remarkably good-looking face. Its one fault was its lack of strength. It was softly effeminate, almost girlish. The features were small, regular, and delicate. The chin was weak, and the mouth was weak. There was no strength nor character in the jaws, forehead, and nose. In the eyes only could be caught any hint of the unknown quantities that were so large a part of his makeup, and that other persons could not understand. These unknown quantities were pluck, pertinacity, fearlessness, imagination, and cunning, and when they found expression in some consistent and striking action, those about him were astounded. Maki's father was chief over the village at Port Adams, and thus, by birth a saltwater man, Maki was half amphibian. He knew the way of the fishes and oysters, and the reef was an open book to him. Canoes, also, he knew. He learned to swim when he was a year old. At 7 years he could hold his breath a full minute and swim straight down to bottom through 30 feet of water. And at 7 years he was stolen by the bushmen, who cannot even swim, and who are afraid of salt water. Thereafter Maki saw the sea only from a distance, through rifts in the jungle, and from open spaces on the high mountain sides. He became the slave of old Fanfoa, head chief over a score of scattered bush villages on the range lips of Malaita, the smoke of which, on calm mornings, is about the only evidence the seafaring white men have of the teeming interior population. For the whites do not penetrate Malaita. They tried it once, in the days when the search was on for gold, but they always left their heads behind to grin from the smoky rafters of the bushmen's huts. When Mokai was a young man of 17, Fanfoa got out of tobacco. He got dreadfully out of tobacco. It was hard times in all his villages. He had been guilty of a mistake. Suwa was a harbor so small that a large schooner could not swing an anchor in it. It was surrounded by mangroves that overhung the deep water. It was a trap, and into the trap sailed two white men in a small ketch. They were after recruits, and they possessed much tobacco and trade goods, to say nothing of three rifles and plenty of ammunition. Now there were no saltwater men living at Suwa, and it was there that the bushmen could come down to the sea. The ketch did a splendid traffic. It signed on 20 recruits the first day. Even old Fanfoa signed on. And that same day the score of new recruits chopped off the two white men's head, killed the boat's crew, and burned the ketch. Thereafter, and for 3 months, there was tobacco and trade goods in plenty, and to spare in all the bush villages. Then came the man of war, that threw shells 4 miles into the hills, frightening the people out of their villages and into the deeper bush. Next the man of war sent landing parties ashore. The villages were all burned, along with the tobacco and trade stuff. The coconuts and bananas were chopped down, the taro gardens uprooted, and the pigs and chickens killed. It taught Fanfoa a lesson, but in the meantime he was out of tobacco. Also, his young men were too frightened to sign on with the recruiting vessels. That was why Fanfoa ordered his slave, Maki, to be carried down and signed on for half a case of tobacco advance, along with knives, axes, calico, and beads, which he would pay for with his toil on the plantations. Mokai was sorely frightened when they brought him on board the schooner. He was a lamb led to the slaughter. White men were ferocious creatures. They had to be, or else they would not make a practice of venturing along the Malaita coast and into all harbors, two on a schooner, when each schooner carried from 15 to 20 blacks as boat's crew, and often as high as 60 or 70 black recruits. In addition to this, there was always the danger of the shore population, the sudden attack and the cutting off of the schooner and all hands. Truly, white men must be terrible. Besides, they were possessed of such devil's rifles that shot very rapidly many times, things of iron and brass that made the schooners go when there was no wind, and boxes that talked and laughed just as men talked and laughed. And he had heard of one white man whose particular devil was so powerful that he could take out all his teeth and put them back at will. Down into the cabin they took Maki. On deck, the one white man kept guard with two revolvers in his belt. In the cabin the other white man sat with a book before him, in which he inscribed strange marks and lines. He looked at Mokai, as though he had been a pig or a fowl, glanced under the hollows of his arms, and wrote in the book. Then he held out the writing stick and Mokai just barely touched it with his hand, in so doing pledging himself to toil for 3 years on the plantations of the Moonglium Soap Company. It was not explained to him that the will of the ferocious white men would be used to enforce the pledge, and that, behind all, for the same use, was all the power and all the warships of Great Britain. Other blacks there were on board, from unheard of far places, and when the white man spoke to them, they tore the long feather from Maki's hair, cut that same hair short, and wrapped about his waist a lava of bright yellow calico. After many days on the schooner, and after beholding more land and islands than he had ever dreamed of, he was landed on New Georgia, and put to work in the field clearing jungle and cutting cane grass. For the first time he knew what work was. Even as a slave to Fanfoa he had not worked like this. and he did not like work. It was up at dawn and in the dark, on two meals a day, and the food was tiresome. For weeks at a time they were given nothing but sweet potatoes to eat, and for weeks at a time it would be nothing but rice. He cut out the coconut from the shells day after day, and for long days and weeks he fed the fires that smoked the copra, till his eyes got sore, and he was set to felling trees. He was a good axe man, and later he was put in the bridge building gang. Once, he was punished by being put in the road building gang. At times he served as boat's crew in the whale boats, when they brought in copra from distant beaches, or when the white men went out to dynamite fish. Among other things he learned Dutch steamer English, with which he could talk with all white men, and with all recruits who otherwise would have talked in 1,000 different dialects. Also, he learned certain things about the white men, principally that they kept their word. If they told a boy he was going to receive a stick of tobacco, he got it. If they told a boy they would knock 7 bells out of him, if he did a certain thing, when he did that thing, 7 bells invariably were knocked out of him. Mawkey did not know what 7 bells were, but they occurred in Bechtemer, and he imagined them to be the blood and teeth that sometimes accompanied the process of knocking out 7 bells. One other thing he learned. No boy was struck or punished unless he did wrong. Even when the white men were drunk, as they were frequently, they never struck unless a rule had been broken. Mawkey did not like the plantation. He hated work, and he was the son of a chief. Furthermore, it was 10 years since he had been stolen from Port Adams by Fanfoa, and he was homesick. He was even homesick for the slavery under Fanfoa. So he ran away. He struck back into the bush, with the idea of working southward to the beach, and stealing a canoe in which to go home to Port Adams. But the fever got him, and he was captured and brought back more dead than alive. A second time he ran away, in the company of 2 Malaita boys. They got down the coast 20 miles, and were hidden in the hut of a Malaita freeman, who dwelt in that village. But in the dead of night 2 white men came, who were not afraid of all the village people, and who knocked 7 bells out of the 3 runaways, tied them like pigs, and tossed them into the whale boat. But the man in whose house they had hidden 7 times 7 bells must have been knocked out of him from the way the hair, skin, and teeth flew, and he was discouraged for the rest of his natural life from harboring runaway laborers. For a year Mawkey toiled on. Then he was made a houseboy, and had good food and easy times, with light work in keeping the house clean, and serving the white men with whiskey and beer at all hours of the day, and most hours of the night. He liked it, but he liked Port Adams more. He had 2 years longer to serve, but 2 years were too long for him in the throes of homesickness. He had grown wiser with his year of service, and, being now a houseboy, he had opportunity. He had the cleaning of the rifles, and he knew where the key to the storeroom was hung. He planned to escape, and one night 10 Malaita boys, and one boy from San Cristobal sneaked from the barracks, and dragged one of the whale boats down to the beach. It was Mawkey who supplied the key that opened the padlock on the boat, and it was Mawkey who equipped the boat with 12 Winchesters, an immense amount of ammunition, a case of dynamite with detonators and fuse, and 10 cases of tobacco. The northwest monsoon was blowing, and they fled south in the nighttime, hiding by day on detached and uninhabited islets, or dragging their whale boat into the bush on the large islands. Thus they gained Guadalcanal, skirted halfway along it, and crossed the indispensable straits to Florida Island. It was here that they killed the San Cristobal boy, saving his head and cooking and eating the rest of him. The Malaita coast was only 20 miles away, but the last night a strong current and baffling winds prevented them from gaining across. Daylight found them still several miles from their goal. But daylight brought a cutter, in which were 2 white men, who were not afraid of 11 Malaita men armed with 12 rifles. Mawkey and his companions were carried back to Tulagi, where lived the great white master of all the white men. and the great white master held a court, after which, one by one, the runaways were tied up and given 20 lashes each, and sentenced to a fine of $15. They were sent back to New Georgia, where the white men knocked 7 bells out of them all around, and put them to work. But Mawkey was no longer houseboy. He was put in the road-making gang. The fine of $15 had been paid by the white men from whom he had run away, and he was told that he would have to work it out, which meant 6 months additional toil. Further, his share of the stolen tobacco earned him another year of toil. Port Adams was now 3 years and a half away, so he stole a canoe one night, hid on the islets in Manning Straits, passed through the straits, and began working along the eastern coast of Isabel, only to be captured two-thirds of the way along by the white men on Merange Lagoon. After a week, he escaped from them and took to the bush. There were no bush natives on Isabel, only saltwater men, who were all Christians. The white men put up a reward of 500 sticks of tobacco, and every time Mawkey ventured down to the sea to steal a canoe, he was chased by the saltwater men. 4 months of this passed, when, the reward having been raised to 1,000 sticks, he was caught and sent back to New Georgia and the road-building gang. Now 1,000 sticks are worth $50, and Mawkey had to pay the reward himself, which required a year and 8 months' labor. So Port Adams was now 5 years away. His homesickness was greater than ever, and it did not appeal to him to settle down and be good, work out his 4 years, and go home. The next time, he was caught in the very act of running away. His case was brought before Mr. Havaby, the island manager of the Moonglium Soap Company, who adjudged him an incorrigible. The company had plantations on the Santa Cruz Islands, hundreds of miles across the sea, and there it sent its Solomon Islands incorrigibles. And there Mawkey was sent, though he never arrived. The schooner stopped at Santa Ana, and in the night Mawkey swam ashore, where he stole 2 rifles and a case of tobacco from the trader, and got away in a canoe to Cristobal. Malaita was now to the north, 50 or 60 miles away. But when he attempted the passage, he was caught by a light gale, and driven back to Santa Ana, where the trader clapped him in irons, and held him against the return of the schooner from Santa Cruz. The 2 rifles the trader recovered, but the case of tobacco was charged up to Mawkey at the rate of another year. The sum of years he now owed the company was 6. On the way back to New Georgia, the schooner dropped anchor in Mare Sound, which lies at the southeastern extremity of Guadalcanal. Mawkey swam ashore with handcuffs on his wrists, and got away to the bush. The schooner went on, but the Moonglium trader ashore offered 1,000 sticks, and to him Mawkey was brought by the bushman with a year and 8 months tacked onto his account. Again, and before the schooner called in, he got away, this time in a whaleboat accompanied by a case of the trader's tobacco. But a northwest gale wrecked him upon Uji, where the Christian native stole his tobacco, and turned him over to the Moonglium trader who resided there. The tobacco the native stole meant another year for him, and the tale was now 8 years and a half. "We'll send him to Lord Howe," said Mr. Havaby. "B. Bunster is there, and we'll let them settle it between them. It will be a case, I imagine, of Mawkey getting Bunster, or Bunster getting Mawkey, and good riddance in either event. If one leaves Merange Lagoon, on Isabel, and steers a course due north, magnetic, at the end of 150 miles he will lift the pounded coral beaches of Lord Howe above the sea. Lord Howe is a ring of land some 150 miles in circumference, several hundred yards wide at its widest, and towering in places to a height of 10 feet above sea level. Inside this ring of sand is a mighty lagoon studded with coral patches. Lord Howe belongs to the Solomons neither geographically nor ethnologically. It is an atoll, while the Solomons are high islands, and its people and language are Polynesian, while the inhabitants of the Solomons are Melanesian. Lord Howe has been populated by the westward Polynesian drift which continues to this day, big outrigger canoes being washed upon its beaches by the southeast trade. that there has been a slight Melanesian drift in the period of the northwest monsoon is also evident. Nobody ever comes to Lord Howe, or on Tom Java as it is sometimes called. Thomas Cook and Son do not sell tickets to it, and tourists do not dream of its existence. Not even a white missionary has landed on its shore. Its 5,000 natives are as peaceable as they are primitive. Yet they were not always peaceable. The sailing directions speak of them as hostile and treacherous. But the men who compile the sailing directions have never heard of the change that was worked in the hearts of the inhabitants, who, not many years ago, cut off a big bark and killed all hands with the exception of the second mate. The survivor carried the news to his brothers. The captains of 3 trading schooners returned with him to Lord Howe. They sailed their vessels right into the lagoon, and proceeded to preach the white man's gospel, that only white men shall kill white men, and that the lesser breeds must keep hands off. The schooners sailed up and down the lagoon, harrying and destroying. There was no escape from the narrow sand circle, no bush to which to flee. The men were shot down at sight, and there was no avoiding being sighted. The villages were burned, the canoes smashed, the chickens and pigs killed, and the precious coconut trees chopped down. For a month this continued, when the schooner sailed away, but the fear of the white man had been seared into the souls of the islanders, and never again were they rash enough to harm one. Max Bunster was the one white man on Lord Howe, trading in the pay of the ubiquitous Moonglium Soap Company. And the company billeted him on Lord Howe, because, next to getting rid of him, it was the most out-of-the-way place to be found. That the company did not get rid of him was due to the difficulty of finding another man to take his place. He was a strapping big German, with something wrong in his brain. Semi-madness would be a charitable statement of his condition. He was a bully and a coward, and a thrice bigger savage than any savage on the island. Being a coward, his brutality was of the cowardly order. When he first went, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.